All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah. All right. Well, it's libertarian foreign policy, mostly, on this show. But today is going to be a little bit more domestic policy-ish, in a way. First of all, I'm really excited. I'm actually nervous, like, when I interview Ron Paul or something. I get all kind of, yeah, I've been doing this a long time. I don't get nervous just talking to you guys so much. But when I got to interview Ron Paul, I got a whole little heartbeat going. Well, I'm all excited because, today I get to talk to Jordan Smith, who is a reporter for the Austin Chronicle, I think still, and, I assume still. I don't know. Maybe she left. Anyway, she's at The Intercept as well, Greenwald's gig. And I've been reading her for years, man. She's this great investigative reporter at the Austin Chronicle, which is sort of like Austin's version of the LA Weekly or whatever free, full-size, magazine-shaped weekly newspaper exists in your town with a bunch of ads on the back. It's just the same all over the country, right? Well, Austin has one. It's called the Austin Chronicle. And she's a real badass, man. Won me over on the yogurt shop murder case and her great coverage of that, which you just couldn't get published in the Austin American Statesman because they're just not good enough. And anyway, she's also been great on the story of Rodney Reed. Here we are. We're in the future now. We're up against it. They're going to execute him. You know, I considered getting her on the show about this years ago. And I thought, well, you know, I guess we'll see how it goes. And it's not exactly my beat. Hell of a story, though. And maybe I'm just lazy. I should have gotten around to it, and I didn't. I don't know. Now, here we are. They're going to kill him. The government of Texas is going to murder Rodney Reed. And I guess, you know, Lois Lane herself couldn't stop him. All the journalism in the world can't stop him. I don't know. We'll see what happens. He ain't dead yet. But Jordan Smith is going to be on the show to talk about the framing and the conspiracy to murder Rodney Reed by lethal injection. They're appealing. They're working on it. And then also Dave Mass is going to be on the show. He's from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And, you know, when I saw this story, I thought, nuh-uh. And then I thought, well, yeah, of course, you know. But, man, did you see this? Are you a Twitter junkie like me? Did you see this headline at Think Progress? In North Carolina, people, humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, individuals in prison are being sent to solitary confinement for decades for using presumably smuggled smartphones to update Facebook. Facebook posts from prison. Because, hey, that's what the rules say, because it's right here in the Schedule 2 penalty applied to this, that, whatever checkbox says this one guy has earned himself, I'm sure the warden says, 37 years. That's my whole lifetime, right? I'm 38. My lifetime. In solitary confinement. In solitary. For updating Facebook. Not for cutting a prison guard's or 10 of their throats, for updating Facebook in America. You know, mom and pie and baseball and freedom and justice and liberty and an enlightenment population that uses reason in order to decide how best to apply the law and stuff. I almost don't believe it, and yet, of course, why not? I'm sorry, sir. The computer says. 37 years in the hole. Dave Mass is going to be on from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, talk about that. And then John Esposito, we got him. John Esposito is going to be on. He is from the Gallup poll. Sorry for the background noise. I forgot to turn the heater off. I'll get it at the break. John Esposito is from the Gallup poll, and he has co-authored this book back in 2008. It's called Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. And so, yeah, I emphasize the Gallup poll thing there because, you see, this is not somebody saying, oh, yeah, well, I've been to Egypt, and I talked to some Islams, and here's what they told me. Nope. This is the Gallup poll. And they went and did in-depth surveys, not telephone polls, real surveys. And, you know, whatever. Any polling's methodology should be questioned to some degree or whatever, unless your intent is to ignore all the truth that they have to say. In which case, you know, forget your objections. But it's okay to double-check and second-guess questioning and methods and sample size and where the samples are gotten from and whatever. None of that is perfect science. It's social science, which means it's not really science. It's just trying, kinda. You know. Even a poll is like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle kind of thing. A survey, just the form of it determines what kind of answer you're going to get in a lot of ways. And so, you know how it goes. Anyway, I think it's fair to make those caveats. But the real point is, they went and asked serious questions to Muslims from Morocco to the Philippines. All of them, in every Islamic society they could find. And maybe in the worst war zones, they stayed out of Fallujah at the time, or whatever it was. In 2008, you can't really go Gallup polling in Fallujah. But they did their best. And I think that you'll be interested to hear what it was that their research showed. That's what you say when it's social science. You don't say proved, you say showed. Because, yeah, you know, proved. I don't know. Don't want to overstate things. But it's very instructive. Even if you already have a good head on your shoulders about these kind of issues, I think, you know, it'd be interesting to learn. And speaking of which, I'm glad that I went on and on about that subject because someone just sent me a tweet over the weekend, and it was a clip of Reza Azatlan or something. I do not know the dude's name. Oh, hell, I won't be able to even find it for you, too. I retweeted it, but you'll have to page down and down because I tweet too damn much. But it was this guy. His name is Reza Azatlan or something, and I think he's an American academic. And they have him on CNN, unfortunately not to confront Bill Maher, but to confront blonde lady and blonde black guy, you know, asking their dits questions. No offense to the blonde ladies out there. I don't mean to sound too sexist, but it's really kind of a ridiculous thing. It's just a couple of two idiots asking this guy these baseless questions. It's ridiculous. But anyway, so they're saying, they're basically representing the Bill Maher point of view and saying, yeah, but isn't it true how Muslims are all violent and how Muslims oppress people and this and that? And this guy, Reza Azatlan, just completely mops the floor with them. No. And of course, his answer every time, and without being manipulative, not in a Donald Rumsfeld deconstructionist way, but in an honest way, he just absolutely challenges them on even the premise of your question, of their question. You know, doesn't this or that activity that takes place in Pakistan prove this or that about the other billion Muslims in the world? No, it doesn't. What are you, an idiot? How could you even ask that? And he just kicks their ass. Oh, and you know what it was? It was that guy from the Young Turks, the guy that used to be on MSNBC. He had like a highlight reel of it. So if you know who I'm talking about, what's the guy's name again? Cenk Younger. Yeah. Go to his website and look where he has like a best of clip of this guy, Reza Azatlan, arguing Islam on CNN. It's really good, man. It's worth your time to look at. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys, if you go to my Twitter, you don't have to be on it to look at it. If you go my Twitter, twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, I just tweeted that clip I was talking about. Joseph Hickman. God dang it. Procrastination just caught up with me. What am I going to do? I live in this world where I have to sleep at night. And it really sucks because that's when I need to stay awake and read books. I need the nighttime. This guy Hickman is an American hero, sort of, kind of, at least, man. And the other Scott Horton is a bona fide, absolute, genuine American hero. And he did all the great journalism on how this guy Hickman showed that the CIA murdered these three dudes down at Guantanamo, called it a suicide, like this is Arkansas or Waco or something. Holy moly, are you kidding me? Yeah, no, really. Penny Lane, they denied it even existed. It was called Camp No, but yeah, now we know it's in the Senate torture report. It's called Penny Lane. And it was a CIA secret black site down at Guantanamo Bay. And I got Hickman's book. It's right here. And in fact, I'm trying to knock out other Scott Horton's book before I get to Hickman's book. And now I got Hickman saying, hey, man, come on with the interview. And of course, he's joking, but he's right. I got to get to it. I'm going to have to start doing drugs. That's it. I'm going to have to figure out some kind of something to keep me awake at night. You know, just for a few weeks. And I'm not asking for the CIA to come and kidnap me and keep me away for a few weeks. That's different. No, please. I'm talking about, you know, score from a friend somehow and stay away and just catch up on some books. You know, I gotta catch up on some books. Sorry. Hey, guess what? Me and Jeff Tucker are starting a new thing at liberty.me. He's gonna interview me once a month. Or so. At least that's the plan so far. And here's the other thing, too. I think everybody's agreed on this. We're going to call it Eye on the Empire, named after the column in honor of the late, great, heroic Alan Bock, former columnist for antiwar.com and, of course, the Orange County Register. And he was such a great guy and such a great libertarian and such a great anti-imperialist. And he's the first guy I interviewed when I started doing the interview show in April of 2003. And I really love the guy. I got to spend some time with him when I lived out in L.A. And then he died, which sucks. I mean, I know everybody dies, but it'd be so much better if he was still alive. But anyway, so we're going to name the show after his column, Eye on the Empire. And it'll be Jeff Tucker interviewing me about what the hell's going on around here. More or less. And so that'll be at liberty.me. Sign up. Go to my website, scotthorton.org, and right there in the right-hand column, you can find the link. Click through, and I'll even get a dollar kickback or something. Liberty.me. Join up. It's awesome. It's like, I don't want to say it's like Facebook for libertarians, because it's a lot more than that. It's really cool. And I hate Facebook, so I don't want to, like, I'm not trying to attack it. I think it's great. I quit Facebook. I'm almost a year clean from Facebook. And more, I think I gotta quit Twitter, too. I guess if people want to argue with me, that's one thing. But I keep picking fights with people who, of course they're lying. Why do I need to stop and waste an hour fighting with them? Anyway, that's why I don't get any books read. Twitter. Facebook and Twitter, man. They killed my book reading. I have not given up on emailing Dennis Kucinich every day for 3 weeks because he keeps telling me to keep trying. Like every 5 emails he answers and says, try me again tomorrow. Try me again on Monday. So, all right, you got it. God dang it. I'm getting this interview. I still, you know, I have the awesome tab kit for Mozilla. You got to have the tab kit. And so I have my collection, this three-part series, plus all the audio from this Washington Times story. I just can't bear to click X on them yet. It's so great. I want to keep talking about it. I want to interview Dennis Kucinich about it. It's this awesome story. I know I say Washington Times, and you say, yeah, tell me when he's done quoting from Sung Young Moon's so-called newspaper. But wait. Even though this is not by James Bovard and it's in the Washington Times, it's still awesome. It's Kelly Riddell, and I interviewed her about it, and she's solid on it. And they got the audio. And it's about how Hillary Clinton lied us into war in 2011 and how the Pentagon, not just Dennis Kucinich, Mr. Peacenik Democrat in the House, the Ron Paul of the Democrats, not just Kucinich, the Pentagon tried to stop her. The Pentagon tried to stop her. You got to read this thing if you didn't read it. Say, I don't know, hadn't listened to the show in a while, just tuning in, or you're brand new around here and you don't know about this story. Go and look at it at the Washington Times. It's incredible. And yes, their website is a catastrophe, but just click on the printer. The printer version is great. The printer version is great. So, yes, the Washington Times website is an absolute just, my God, man. But just click on the printer version, and then it'll be fine. That's at thewashingtontimes.com. Hillary Clinton's WMD moment. U.S. intelligence saw false narrative in Libya. Secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libya war, and secret Benghazi report reveals Hillary's Libya war push armed al-Qaeda-tied terrorists. You're damn right. And yes, it's true that this is 4 years after the fact. It's just confirmation of what we were telling you in real time here on this show, but it's from sources we didn't have. We sure didn't know all of what the head of AFRICOM and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were doing to try to keep her from doing this. God almighty, what a story. So Kucinich, he's coming on soon. Sometime this week, probably. Okay. And then, I guess... In just a minute, let me mention here real quick the story of the White House putting down some edict that no one is to share any information with Israel on... Where the hell is my link on this? I lost my link. It's on antiwar.com somewhere, I believe. Yeah, because I sent it to Eric yesterday. It was in Haaretz. Oh, here, I can find it in the IM here. God dang. There was something. Oh, here it is in Haaretz right here. Here's my link, right? Oh, and you know what? Speaking of the Washington Times, Arnaud de Borgrave died. And I interviewed him back in 2007 or so about Israeli threats to bomb Iran from air bases in Azerbaijan, which is something you might want to listen to. I don't know everything about the guy, but he seemed like he was a decent guy. He was sort of a Pat Buchanan type, maybe not as good as Pat, but a little bit paleo, and so sometimes good on wars and stuff for a right-winger. But anyway, rest in peace, Arnaud. And I know he was bad on some stuff, too. I'm not saying he was that great, but what the hell. He was a friend of the show. He was an all right guy. Fearing leaks, U.S. limiting information it shares with Israel on Iran nuke talks. That's at Haaretz. Look at that. Right back with Jordan Smith in just a sec. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Jordan Smith, great reporter, formerly with the Austin Chronicle, who I've read for years and years on the Yogurt Shop case, as well as this Rodney Reed story. Sorry. And she's now at The Intercept with Greenwald and them. Chronic Jordan, underscore, Chronic underscore Jordan is her handle on Twitter if you want to follow her there. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jordan?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to have you on the show here. And, you know, I meant to interview you actually about this story years ago, and I guess I'm just lazy and never got around to it. But now we're actually, less than 3 weeks away from the execution of Rodney Reed, and I saw where, I guess KXAN put out a little thing last night saying that the family has now petitioned, get a new trial. And so I guess that's at the state level. Are there various, appeals? And I'm sorry, we'll get to the story in just a second, this innocent man on death row. But, I'm curious about, the different states of appeal in the federal courts, the Supreme Court, et cetera, too.
So there's nothing pending in federal court right now. There's a couple things happening at the state level. First of all, there's a clemency petition that's been filed with the Board of Pardons and Paroles. But in Texas, we know kind of how that goes. Not very well, usually, but you try anyway. So that's pending. And then there are a couple of appeals that are kind of wending their way through the system. One has to do with DNA testing. Lawyers had sought to have a bunch of additional DNA testing during a hearing back in November, and that was denied at the trial court level. So that denial is being appealed. Meanwhile, there's this brand new appeal that was filed just this last week on Thursday, that's filed right with the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is Texas's highest criminal court, and they are looking at some new scientific evidence that experts say make the state's theory of the crime medically and scientifically impossible.
Right. And then, so now, it's been a little while since I took Texas government at community college here, but in the appeals, or I guess it depends on what kind of appeal at what kind of court, but mostly it's rigged where the defendant or the convict would have to prove that something was wrong with the process originally, not necessarily that there's a preponderance of evidence to believe now that they may be guilty or something, but they have to show that the judge did something wrong or the prosecution withheld some evidence from the defense that they should have known at trial or something like that. Is that not correct in this case?
Well, generally speaking, that's the case. But for example, with the DNA appeal and the new sort of forensic evidence appeal are a little bit different. They're both kind of taking advantage of relatively recent changes to Texas law that try to give more avenues for defendants to get back into court when things have changed. So, for example, the forensic science part. It is part of the changes that went into effect after Michael Morton's exoneration. Okay, so this is a way to, when science has changed, essentially, when we've evolved and we know now something that we would not necessarily have known in the past, or that wasn't available, that kind of wisdom or an expert to sort of determine that. When those things aren't available, it gives you a little lever to try to get back into court. So with this, they're saying, look, we have these really veteran medical examiners, and we also have the former Austin medical examiner who's kind of changed his story on this. It's backed up by some other really well-known guys, and we're going to try to use this valve for new involving science and get back into the courts. So there are some different ways to get back in, not necessarily, but, you know, you're right. Generally speaking, when you're on appeal, you're talking about defects in your trial that kind of offend constitutional principles. That's generally what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, so I'm sorry for starting at the end of a long and complicated story, but I wanted to try to figure out what was going on with the court system. And,
sure.
You know, for starters here. And we will certainly work back around to this expert testimony that's now being recanted from the medical examiner. But I guess, you know, for now, can you rewind and take us back to 1996 and tell us who is Rodney Reed and what is he doing on death row?
Okay, yeah. So we'll give you this, the summary here, which is basically that on April 23rd of 1996, a 19-year-old named Stacy Stites, who lived in Giddings with her then fiance, who was a rookie Giddings police officer. She's found murdered in a wooded area just about 10 miles outside of Bastrop. She was reported missing after she did fail to show up that morning for a 3:30 a.m. shift at the Bastrop HEB. Now, the car she was driving, which belonged to her fiancé, was found about, you know, in Bastrop, about 10 miles from where her body was dumped. And they eventually found her body because a guy picking wildflowers kind of came across it. And so when her body was being inspected, they found, first of all, that there was semen DNA inside of her. And because of the way she was sort of found splayed in the woods, her pants, the zipper was broken. Her pants had clearly been pulled down. Her underwear was sort of bunched up. She didn't have a shirt on, but she did have a bra on. I think there was obviously sort of a quick assumption that this was maybe a sexual assault turned violent into murder. And the case basically revolves entirely on what her fiancé, this man named Jimmy Fennell, who, like I say, was a Giddings police officer, what he said about what happened that morning. And specifically, he said that the day before her murder, that, you know, they were together alone in the apartment and everything was just hunky-dory and they were getting ready, you know, planning their wedding. And then she goes to bed that night. He goes to bed sometime after she goes to bed. And then she leaves at, like, 3 in the morning to go to her shift. And that's, you know, to drive about 30 miles, I guess, from Giddings to Bastrop. So the entire timeline for when Stites was murdered rests entirely on Fennell. The problem is they never actually searched the apartment. It's really become a huge problem in this case, is the cops never sought to search the apartment that the couple shared, even though it's clearly the last place that everybody knew she was alive. And so, you know, there might be something there that you don't even know is there, or you might find evidence that would suggest that what Fennell said happened didn't happen. But suffice it to say, it goes unsolved for about a year until cops decided to compare the DNA that they had gotten from Stites to that of a man who was 29 years old at the time named Rodney Reed. His DNA had been collected in connection with another attempted sexual assault case that was eventually dropped. And there's a match. So the timeline with Fennell's timeline, and then they find the DNA, and they just kind of come up with this theory of the case, which has persisted to this day, that it's kind of problematic, and that is this. Stacy Stites is driving alone in Fennell's truck just after 3 a.m. from Giddings to Bastrop. Along the way, she is somehow overcome by Rodney Reed, who's on foot and without a weapon. He then kidnaps her, rapes her, dumps her in the woods, drives the car back to Bastrop, dumps it behind the high school, and then goes home. And that is the entire theory of the case. Now, when Reed was first arrested, he claimed that he did not know Stites, and he only knew, you know, what he'd heard on the news about the murder. And eventually, he changed that, not too long, actually, after being arrested, and said, look, I did know her. In fact, we were having an affair, and basically, he was afraid to say anything because she was married. He's a black man. She was a young white woman who was also happened to be engaged to a white cop.
All right, now, hardy har har, a likely story. But we got to take this break. Music's playing. Two clarifications there. Giddings and Bastrop, audience, these are towns east of Austin, Texas, small towns east of Austin. And HEB, that's the grocery store where she worked. That's just a Texas thing. Hold it right there. It's Jordan Smith, the great Jordan Smith, now at The Intercept on the false prosecution of Rodney Reed sitting on Texas death row.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jordan Smith, formerly with the Austin Chronicle. Did a lot of great work there for many years on the Yogurt Shop murders case, as well as this case, Rodney Reed sitting on death row for the murder of Stacy Stites. And sorry about the heartbreak there. They do interrupt, Jordan. But so what we have here is we have... a young lady who was murdered and apparently raped, and we have the DNA of the suspect, and yet you seem to think there's a bunch of reasonable doubt here. How's that?
Well, I think there's always been problems. The state's theory of the crime really, to be quite honest, makes no sense to me. As a woman, I just don't it's very hard to figure out how you're driving down a highway and get overtaken by a man on foot. I don't get that. I never have. There's other things about the scene, too, that are disturbing. Her fingernails are cut sort of to the quick. That didn't make sense to me. She's about to get married. She also works with food. I don't get that. And, you know, obviously they couldn't get any sort of DNA or anything from under the fingernails. And really, the idea that Rodney was having an affair, a relationship with Stacy, was never vetted by the cops in any meaningful way, and neither was Jimmy Finnell, the fiancé. And as it turns out, he has quite a disturbing pattern of sexual assault and stalking of women and of being very violent with minorities. And these were things that actually had begun, the pattern had begun before Stites was even murdered, and continued well on after she was murdered, even during Rodney's trial. And none of this stuff was ever discovered by the defense, and none of it was ever raised by the police. It's just sort of a shocking lack of investigation. And the thing is, now it looks far more likely that Finnell could have had something to do with this or is actually responsible for the murder and not Rodney. And that kind of brings us up to what the new appeal is.
Okay, go ahead.
So Finnell, as I said that he was alone with her the night before she was murdered. Now, in the new appeal, you have three of the literally best-known, most renowned forensic pathologists in the country who've all reviewed crime scene videos and pictures and the autopsy and all these sort of official case documents, and all agree that not only was Stites murdered hours before the state says so, which is like shortly after 3 a.m. is when they say she was killed. They say that she was probably likely murdered well before midnight and was actually just dumped in the woods. Now, if that's the case, then that means that Finnell did it, because he, by his own words, was the only one with her before midnight, the night before she was killed. And they say that they can tell this by looking at the way blood has pooled in Stites' body post-mortem. So, you know, after we die, our blood obviously is no longer circulating, and so it kind of follows gravity and moves to the lowest points in the body. And although she was found on her back, there was distinct, like, lividity looks a lot like bruising, like sort of deep bruises. So there was deep, that sort of deep lividity all over her chest, and on her face, and on part of her arm that was actually facing up when they found her in the woods. So this whole part of her body is purple, which means that she was actually killed at least 4 hours before they said, because it takes about 4 hours for lividity to set. And she was then kept in a position where she was basically slumped forward with her head down and then dumped in the woods on her back. Mm-hmm. So there was lividity on her back because she'd been outside for a long time, but that stuff on the front was still there, and that's how they get this new timeline. So it's pretty, I mean, it's it's just a scientific fact of decomposition, basically. Mm-hmm. That stuff does not change, you know?
Right. Better than just a reasonable doubt there. That sounds beyond it.
Certainly. That's in fact exactly how one of the medical examiners put it, a guy named Michael Bodden, who's probably fairly well known, and he used to be the chief medical examiner in New York City. And in his affidavit, he concluded not only that, you know, science says that this is the way things work, but that he is beyond reasonably, there's no, beyond his reasonable medical certainty that Reed is actually innocent of this crime.
Mm-hmm. And now, so tell us about the recanted testimony of the medical examiner. Was it, well,
right,
whoever it was, the guy that testified at the trial,
right,
about the age of the sperm that they had found?
Exactly. So because Stites was found with Reed's DNA, and they found three intact sperm, heads and tails. So at trial, the former Austin medical examiner, a guy named Roberto Bayardo, testified as well as along with a crime scene analyst, and basically said that sperm cannot last intact inside the vagina for more than 24 hours. And Bayardo kind of went along with this idea that Stites was killed at some point after 3 a.m. He's since recanted that. He said basically that that was wrong and that he never kind of meant to even, say that that was the case. And so that kind of piggybacks the other stuff. But the reality is, and this is what the pathologists say now, too, is if they'd had sex, sometime just before she was murdered, you would expect to see a lot more than three sperm, basically. So the fact that all they could find was three actually further bolsters Reed's story that the sex they'd had been several days before.
Well, and if I remember right from the last thing that you wrote about this, well, I don't know if I read this in the Chronicle or not, but I believe it was that there are other experts in literature and the journals, et cetera, that explicitly refute the idea that the tails must have had to have broken off after 24 hours, just not correct.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That it's scientifically inaccurate to say that's the case. So you got two things going on. Number one, it's documented that you can find intact sperm for days later. But also you've got the whole idea that all they found was three, and they made a big deal out of that. But now when you look at it and you think, well, that doesn't make any sense. How could you have just had sex with somebody and only have three sperm? That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So, all these things together, and it's taken so many years for all of these sort of pieces of information to kind of come together, and now we have a much broader picture of what might have happened to Miss Stites.
Well, now, how many, I want to ask you about Jimmy Fennell more in a minute, but how many people can confirm that, and maybe could back then and now, if the numbers are different, can confirm that Rodney Reed was, in fact, having an affair with this woman, rather than that's just his made-up alibi after the fact, which is what any rapist murderer would say, right?
So at the time, there were a number of people, not many of them were called at trial. In fact, all but two witnesses. And he had quite a number of witnesses who said that they knew of the affair. The problem was, in the defense's estimation, is there were some credibility problems with some of them because some had criminal records and this and that and the other thing. And I think part of it also is that a lot of people were people who were related to him or very close friends of the family. I don't think that necessarily makes them not credible because, if you're doing something that's very secret, the only people that are likely to know about it are people very close to you, and that would be sort of your family. But more to the point is that the cops never even went and looked for to confirm or deny this whole relationship. And so now we have, for example, there are two new people who have come forward. They both worked with Stites at the grocery store, and both say they were never questioned by police about the murders, but had they been, they would have told them what they knew, and that they both gave details of seeing Rodney and Stacy together at the grocery store, sort of behaving affectionately. And I think those witnesses really, they don't have the same credibility problems others might have.
You quote the one in your piece at The Intercept today, you quote the one, or I don't know if it's a direct quote, but you have her saying that Stites had explained to her that, I'm having an affair with this guy.
Right, exactly. She did over lunch in a break room, said that she was having an affair with this black guy named Roddy and that she didn't know what would happen if her fiancé found out. Mm-hmm. The other coworker kind of said that he had seen the two of them together and that she always seemed really happy when Rodney was around, but that she behaved far differently when Jimmy would come by the grocery store, that she actually would run and hide to avoid talking to him.
Okay, and now, why might that be? Can you tell us anything in the last couple of minutes here that we might need to know about Jimmy Fennell?
Well, Jimmy Fennell has a sort of a disturbing pattern of menacing, stalking, and in fact raping at least one woman while on duty as a cop, and that didn't come out until 2008.
Yeah, but you didn't just say the word allegedly. You just said raping. How can you be so sure?
He's in prison right now for doing it.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
He raped a woman while he was working as a Georgetown cop, which is the town just north of Austin. And he raped her while he was on duty. He put her on the back of his car. He put his gun next to her head. He raped her, and he's in prison for that now. And it turned out, because of this situation that happened back in 2007 and was prosecuted in 2008, a number of other women kind of came out of the woodwork and said they'd been menaced by him and threatened with assault and all sorts of things. So There's a really sort of disturbing picture of what Fennell is like in the world.
Hey, Jordan, listen, this is heroic work that you have been doing on this case for years now. Thank you, and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all, that's Jordan Smith. She's formerly at the Austin Chronicle, read all that stuff, and now at the Intercept. She's got a brand new one today on this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Got my earphones on. Next up is Dave Mass. He's at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. You won't even believe this. Yeah, you will. Hundreds of South Carolina inmates sent to solitary confinement over Facebook. Are you kidding me? Welcome to the show, Dave. How are you doing? Oh, I hit the wrong button. Welcome to the show, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate it. I hit the phone instead of the Skype button there. I do that sometimes. Let's see. It says here you are media relations coordinator and investigative researcher at EFF. Very good to have you here. Is this really right? Hundreds of men sent to solitary over Facebook. How do they get on Facebook, and how long are they being sent to solitary?
Well, inmates get on Facebook one of two ways. Either they get a hold of a contraband cell phone and then they access themselves, or what is also frequently the case, they have someone on the outside access Facebook for them. Say, you know, somebody's in prison and says, hey, mom, can you post to Facebook saying, hey, I love everybody, I'm okay. So those are the two ways they go about doing it. But either way, whether it's through a contraband cell phone or whether it's through a loved one, those are against the rules in the South Carolina prison system. And over the last 3 years, more than 400 inmates have received punishments under this policy. Three quarters of them received solitary confinement sentences, ranging from anywhere from a day to 37 years. The average punishment across the 400 was 512 days in solitary confinement.
Unreal. All right, now, so first we got to parse that whole thing about the difference between using a smuggled cell phone versus writing a letter home to mom and saying, will you update my Facebook status to say, hey, everybody, you know, I'm doing okay or whatever, that they are getting solitary confinement for that?
It works both ways for the South Carolina Department of Corrections. They don't care how you access
Facebook.
I guess
they can write the rule however they want, right?
Yeah.
It's not even a law. It's just a rule.
Yeah, it's just a rule. And half the time, they don't even necessarily know how the person accessed Facebook. They only know the person had a contraband cell phone if, A, they find the cell phone in the prisoner's cell, or the inmate has posted a selfie of them in which it's, you know, self-evident that the person had a cell phone. So sometimes they just don't know. They just don't know at all.
Unreal. And then now 37 years, this is a guy who's a serial killer who's serial killed a bunch of guards in order to update his Facebook page, right?
No, it's that's not the case at all. Let me tell you how they break this down. They have decided arbitrarily, there's no rhyme or reason for why they decided to do this, is they decided that the way they're going to level the punishment is that for every day an inmate accesses Facebook, that is a separate, what's called level one offense. So an inmate who accesses Facebook 100 times on Monday only gets one level one offense. But an inmate who accesses Facebook one day on Monday, once on Tuesday, once on Wednesday, gets three level one offenses. So three times the punishment. Now, with the individual who got it 37 times, he's there on a burglary charge, he had accessed Facebook 38 times. And as a result, he got 13,680 days in disciplinary detention, which is solitary confinement. I'm looking at his other charges. When he was caught with narcotics, he didn't get any disciplinary detention when he threatened to injure an employee. He only got 41 days in disciplinary detention. Think about that. Like, you get you threaten a guard, you get 41 days in solitary confinement. You post to social media, you get 37 years in solitary confinement. That's the kind of justice system we're talking about here.
Unreal. And, you know, I don't know. It's funny the way it works when people like us who aren't in prison, knock on wood, talk about and think about people in prison. And it's sort of like Stalin and the one death is a crime and a sin, but a million's just a statistic and all of that, where 30 years, you know, yeah, it's two digits, but it's a three. It could be like 50 something or life or, you know, the way you hear sentences named, sometimes maybe in comparison, 30 something, anything sounds like maybe not that much. But then another way to look at it would be that's all but 1 year of my entire lifetime. I'm 38 years old. 37 years? That's back to the mid-70s, guys. That's a long time. And then solitary confinement, that's the kind of thing where, you know, any civilized person could only even entertain the concept if it was a case where, like I was joking there, he serial killed a bunch of guards in a day. Well, you got to lock him in the hole for, I don't know, a few days or something, I guess. I don't know. I'll overlook something like that. But this is torture, really, locking someone in solitary confinement. It's even if you call it the lowest level, no touch type of torture, it's still a psychological torture. And when you're talking about decades and decades, is there no human being anywhere who can notice that the algorithm here is not working out the correct function or whatever, and that they need to rethink this, or they're just fold their arms and shrug and say, law is the law?
I mean, that might be what the prison's doing. They seem to have dug in and are defending this policy. But it's not only is it inhumane for the inmate. I mean, it's totally impractical for the prison itself. The prison has had to let suspend sentences for disciplinary detention on a regular basis because they have too many people who need to be in solitary confinement, but not enough spaces in solitary confinement. And well, here's your reason for it right there. I mean, I'm not saying anybody should be in solitary confinement for long periods of time, but it seems ridiculous to have it fill up because you're giving people impossible sentences that they won't even be able to serve. I mean, Taim Henry, who got the 37 years, is only set to be in prison for another 10 or 15. So he's never going to actually be able to serve the 37 years they gave him. But, I mean, so why level that kind of punishment if it's not going to actually have any impact whatsoever on this inmate?
Yeah. Well, and still, you know, 15 years in solitary confinement is about as severe, I guess, you know. All the prison is a few miles outside of town, so most of the rest of us don't have to think about it very much. And so, you know, it's complete inhumanity going on.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
With just a shrug. Now, so there's got to be some kind of bleeding heart somebody in South Carolina politics who's making a fuss about this, no?
Well, we only released this report on Thursday, so it's only been a couple of days. What I can tell you is that, you know, there's a... In South Carolina, there's a pretty popular blog called Fitz News, which has done a lot to, you know, point out inmates on Facebook and bring it to the attention of the authorities. Like, that has been one of their go-to news articles. And they put out an article saying, whoa, you know, we've complained about this, but we had no idea the punishments were this harsh. This is way too much for even us. Aiken Standard, which is one of the daily newspapers in South Carolina, put out an editorial, I believe today, saying that this needed to be overhauled.
Oh, that's
we'll see where
important.
It goes from there. I mean, yeah. I think we've had in excess of 30 national news stories written on this at this point. So whether the South Carolina policymakers care what everyone else in the country has to say, well, I don't know. Hopefully it'll pick up.
Well, yeah, you know why? Because it has that kind of Terry Gilliam farce kind of a of a flavor to it, too, where it's like, wait, 37 years for Facebook, where even people who don't care find it curious kind of thing, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, most people, if they imagine themselves in prison, they can imagine, well, I would never stab somebody, I would never rape somebody, I would never try to escape. But I think your average person imagining themselves behind bars, somebody hands them a contraband cell phone, they're going to call their family member.
Hey, and I just interviewed a lady, a reporter, about a guy who's about to be executed for a crime that we know he didn't commit, and that's a death penalty case. So if you think innocent men aren't sitting in prison for burglary, you're crazy. Yeah. You know, for all I know, I don't presume he's guilty just because he's been convicted, this guy. But anyway, hang on, we'll be right back in just 1 second, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with Dave Mass from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. And we're talking about this piece, which I'm very grateful to now understand has caused a bit of a reaction in journalistic circles and including in South Carolina. The headline is, "Hundreds of South Carolina Inmates Sent to Solitary Confinement Over Facebook." And as we discussed, the check boxes on the form are so, you know, set up in such a way that this one guy has been, I guess, sentenced, I don't know the exact term for it. They've sent him away for 37 years of solitary confinement over some Facebook posts when he's not even facing that much time left on his sentence overall. At least they haven't extended his sentence to 37 years just to keep him in solitary, if we understand that part right, Dave, I guess. But now, so I guess I want to ask you, what can prisons do about cell phones? Because everybody in prison who wants a cell phone has one, right?
I mean, it tends to be a big problem. From what I read, lots of prisons, lots of cell phones are getting into prisons. Inmates are getting their hands on it, whether that's from guards smuggling them in or people throwing them over the fence. I mean, it's a recognizable problem. I don't think the solution to it is to come up with an extremely draconian system of punishing per social media post. That's like saying if somebody, you know, they're trying to keep pencils out of the prison, and then you go out and punish somebody for every post-it note they write on. The punishment is having the pencil, not the various notes you wrote with it. Unless, of course, you know, an inmate is using the phone to harass, you know, a victim or to engage in criminal enterprise, but those are usually crimes in and of themselves.
Yeah, and you know, what about no TV for 2 weeks or something rather than put them in the hole?
Oh, well, they get that too. I mean, typically, you know, they might get 37 years in solitary, but they're going to get 75 years loss of television, visitation, canteen, and telephone privileges. So they're going to lose all communication with the outside world, which is kind of sad, because the only reason people, you know, want to access, the main reason people want to access Facebook or any social media is to maintain a connection with the outside world. And people are desperate to do so, and that's been shown to be very important to reducing recidivism rates, to making sure people reintegrate into communities. So, you know, cutting someone off from Facebook and then cutting them off from everything else, I don't know that that really serves the population at large, doesn't serve the inmate, doesn't serve the community. It's just a very, very severe punishment.
Well, I got a great idea for a letter to the editor there in South Carolina. Would be something like, hey, when these guys are in solitary confinement, that means they're not being forced to work for free. And we all know that's what prisoners are for. That's the loophole in the 13th Amendment, after all. And so these guys have all been convicted of something. And so shouldn't they be out there in the fields making money for this or that tobacco farmer or this or that alfalfa farmer?
that's beyond my knowledge as a researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but you probably aren't too far from the truth there.
I can see, you know, all the ears and eyes, eyebrows perking up. Hey, he's got a good point there. We ought to let these guys out of solitary so that, you know, it's, they're not just making license plates, you know. They're answering phones for big corporations. I guess you might know about that, you know, guys in prison being forced to do technology work for industry for 10 cents an hour or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of telemarketing. I've heard of that. Lots of different kinds of prison industry, for sure. For sure. That's definitely going on.
Crazy. All right. So now let's move on to this other thing that you wrote, because I'm hoping that you understand the latest developments here in a way that you could explain them to me, because there was a big announcement. And I know it was after, as according to this note on the article, it says the announcement came after the article that Eric Holder was going to scale back to some tremendous degree the federal civil asset forfeiture program. And then there are a few developing stories that seem to come out after that saying, well, you know, maybe not so much. And I was wondering if before we get into, you know, the real meat of this thing and you know, how it works and all, if you can talk about, you know, where we're at with that, if there really has been a significant change made or just, you know, on TV.
Sure, sure. So, you know, what happened was back in, you know, in the mid-January, Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States, said that he was going to be reining in the federal asset forfeiture program. And it was rolled out saying that this would be something that would significantly limit a lot of the problems that have been reported, both in like the Washington Post and on John Oliver's TV show. And a lot of things that, you know, people like you and I have been railing about for years. And initially people were very, optimistic about what this would mean. I think Reason and a few other publications have pointed out that when he says he's going to cut down the civil forfeiture program, it leaves a giant loophole for any kind of local law enforcement task force that's involved with, federal law enforcement at all. So,
which is all of them.
Yeah, which is almost all of them. I mean, to put another way, if Los Angeles Police Department is involved in itself in a case, it can't necessarily use the assets, you know, seize the assets and then pocket them like it did before. However, if the LAPD is involved in a special task force and there happens to be a member of the DEA on that task force, then they can probably still go about it like they did before. So I still want to be, you know, I don't know that I'm as pessimistic as Reason is that this will be a drop in the bowl, but I don't necessarily know this is going to be the complete overhaul that we thought it was. But perhaps one thing also to consider is that Eric Holder is not going to be the Attorney General for very much longer. And, you know, the next Attorney General or the next administration's Attorney General could easily flip this program back on. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in fact, the incoming Attorney General, apparently not confirmed yet, but she's a big fan of this and says, what are you talking about? Get rid of it.
Yeah. She had expressed support during her hearings. And that was worrisome to me for sure.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it was even sort of in a context like, what are you talking about? She'd never heard anyone complain before. It's purely a wonderful tool for law enforcement to protect everybody with. That's all. What do you mean there's a problem?
Well, I mean, she worked in law enforcement, so anyone who's in law enforcement likes the free money they've gotten out of it and what it's been allowed to do. You know, they've been allowed to buy themselves nice little trinkets and gifts and make donations to their favorite charities and buy swag to give out to the community and also, you know, buy all sorts of toys, law enforcement toys that would not necessarily have gotten through the normal budgeting process.
Well, and as you say in here, including a lot of real high-tech stuff that's used to violate our privacy.
Oh, for sure. So that's one of the things that, you know, I had been digging into this research on asset forfeiture and electronic surveillance for many, many, many months. And it was only, I knew a big story was going to be coming up on asset forfeiture. I didn't know that the announcement was going to be made. And so I had to like rejigger it at the last minute. But, you know, basically what you see is that law enforcement, and we particularly looked at California because we're based in California, that you can definitely see law enforcement using wiretaps and other types of electronic surveillance to go after cases that will result in them seizing lots of money and cars and things like that. Then that money gets converted into asset forfeiture funds, which they then use to buy more equipment to do more electronic surveillance, to grab more stuff that they can turn into money that they can use to buy more electronic surveillance. And I can keep going in that until I pass out blue in the face on the floor. But, you know, it is a cycle of electronic surveillance equals money equals electronic surveillance.
Right. Well, you know, the thing about it is, and this is true for me way back when, and it's true for a lot of people that I've spoken with before, that this is one issue that just really makes regular non-political type people really question what in the hell world they're living in, what country they're living in, when they hear about purely innocent people who the government simply are the robbers, and that's it. And the cops are the robbers. They come, they take their money away, and then they would have to spend a couple $100,000 on legal representation to get their $20,000 back. Oh, well. And, you know, I've just had people say, like, that's the thing that made me decide to be a political activist when I first learned about that. That's not fair. That cuts right to the, you know, very most basic kind of even elementary school civics kind of presumptions about the way things are supposed to work in America. And so it's important always to cover it, to celebrate any victory and to hiss it at, you know, any further push along these lines. Because, you know, if only for the recruitment benefits that come from making a stink out of this particular issue. It just seems to be one that just cuts all the way across the board to any kind of political person or any kind of non-political person reacts the same way when they learn about civil asset forfeiture in America. They just can't believe it, and then they're mad, you know?
Right, right.
Yep. Anyway, I'm sorry for just yelling at you. I was really just trying to say thank you. I that's why I really appreciate this work that you've done here. I think it's really important to cover. All right. Well, and I've kept you over time. So thanks very much, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me. You have a nice President's Day.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all. That is Dave Mass. He is at EFF.org. And we'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Oh no, I should not have gone over time on that last one because I cut short my time to make contact with my next guest. I guess we'll see how it goes. That's the thing about Skype, man. Just is not as reliable as a phone. You don't have to make a contact and share details to call somebody's telephone number, you know? It's always something. Ah, well, so it's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here, well, good thing about Skype is I don't have to stop talking to you to call him. I can just click a thing real quick. So if his symbol does turn green, I will try to bring him on here in the middle of the segment if I have to. Sure do hope that we hear from him. But anyways, or any way, as you might correct me. That's all right, because I was actually sort of upset that I wasn't going to have time to talk about some of the things I wanted to talk about. So, we'll get with John Esposito in a minute, maybe. Or tomorrow, or some other time, I don't know. But yeah, so I wanted to talk about Ukraine and the Islamic State. First of all, in Ukraine, the ceasefire took hold yesterday, and I'm not the master of these details, but I did read in a couple of places that the Ukrainian military forces are surrounded by the rebels and so can't withdraw, and so the maybe much of the shooting has stopped, but not all, and the status quo is untenable. The rebels would have to withdraw and allow the Ukrainian military to get past them, to get out of there, and yet that wasn't part of the deal or something, something, I'm not sure. So, you know, the headline on antiwar.com is minor incidents, but Ukraine ceasefire holds. Contrary to that, over at the Moon of Alabama blog, where they write some pretty intelligent stuff about this, they're saying, you know, this looks to us, Minsk 2 looks just like Minsk 1, which is maybe a temporary break, but it doesn't resolve enough of the issues. And now the optimistic take is Eric Margulies today on antiwar.com. Putin heads off a U.S.-Russia war. And I think part of that argument is that, hey, you have France and Germany really came in here to work this deal out, to hammer this thing out. So that makes it where more powerful people have a greater stake in the ceasefire holding. But then again, you know, I don't know if the Obama government is really on board for going along with France and Germany on this. And maybe they want to undermine it. I mean, I would love to say, ha-ha, so everyone who is calling for arming the Ukrainian government to fight this war better a week ago, you all have to go, you know, jump in a lake from preferably something really, 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 really high. But, you know, I don't know. I guess it still remains to be seen. I'm about 50-50, something pessimistic about it. I don't know. But, you know, part of the terms are, you know, rewrite the part of the Constitution dealing with these regions in eastern Ukraine and how much authority they have and how much authority Kiev has, etc. But this is not an easy kind of thing to work out. But, you know, the Ukrainian government has proved all along since, you know, almost a year ago that they're unable to win this war. You know, this was supposed to be you know, a quick victory. We'll teach them, but now it's a year into this thing almost. And so, no, that's not true. And there are major powers, some of them with many thousands of hydrogen bombs, who are involved in this thing. That's our side and the Russians too. And so, therefore, screw victory, man. Everybody stop shooting and make a deal. What the hell is this? Whether you can get the American Empire to go along with that or not, I don't know. Can they accept the counsel of, you know, the few realists, so-called, who try to interrupt the liberal interventionist neocon consensus about what must be done here and based on what line of crap that's not even true? I don't know. I think Obama doesn't want to have a nuclear war, probably. But it seems like his entire government is full of people who are down for this. And as Andrew Coburn reported on the show, the whole military-industrial complex is excited to ratchet up tensions with Ukraine. Already the increases in spending for NATO projects and all that is music to their ears. They're just getting started. And that's in Harper's this month, Andrew Coburn, Patrick's brother. And I interviewed him about it back in December, I guess. Oh, it was last month's Harper's. Sorry. Anyway, so there are interests, as Scott McConnell explained on the show. Michelle Flournoy wants attention, and she wants to have another hawkish thing on her resume so that she can try to be the Secretary of Defense in a Hillary Clinton administration. And so that's what's going on with her. And then as Stephen Waltz says, Strobe Talbot and those guys at Brookings, well, they're the guys who said that we should expand NATO in the first place, and that has nothing to do with picking a fight with Russia, and the Russians are sure to not take it that way. And so, come on, man, you're paranoid if you think that there's any problem in expanding America's Europe-wide military alliance to everybody but Russia all the way up to their border. You're crazy. Why would they have a problem with that? And so now they're just trying to cover their tracks. And they all have their reasons, but they're petty, tiny, simple reasons. The most coherent one of them is simple greed. a willingness to risk humanity for money. At least that's coherent. You know, Michelle Flournoy could just as easy say, you know what, after helping lose Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm going to try to be a peacemaker and put a little of that on my credibility resume there. Look at my CV, guys. I one time proposed a way that maybe we could help get along with Russia over issues like Ukraine that are so important to them and so peripheral to us, huh? Yeah? Here they are completely destroying, well, here they are undermining the Atlantic Alliance over Ukraine? You want Ukraine that bad? You want to take Ukraine from Russia that bad, huh? They're crazy. And by the way, and I play this clip over and over again. I keep hassling the nice ombudsman lady at the New York Times about it. The clip is Gideon Rose on the Stephen Colbert show just one day after the coup. And he is the editor of the Council on Foreign Relations journal, Foreign Affairs. And he's saying, you know, ha, 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 we're running away with Ukraine. And now what we want to do is be real cool about it, though, while they're distracted with the Olympics. And see if we can get away with taking Ukraine from them in a way where they don't push back too bad. And we're pretty sure it's going to work. We're such brilliant geniuses. We're getting away with it, Stephen. They talked about it. That was the deal. That was the consensus. And not that they asked the American people what we thought. You know, it wasn't a decision made democratically or anything like that. But that was the consensus in New York and D.C. This is what we should do. And, of course, part of that story disproves the narrative since. And to his credit, Gideon Rose has published John Mearsheimer explaining why this is all America's fault, because they did what Gideon Rose thought was such a great idea. So, you know, kudos to him for that, at least. But John Mearsheimer explained, you know, that this was picking a humongous fight. And sorry, the Mearsheimer thing was a tangent. What was I going to say? They disprove the when they tell the truth about their motive, they completely disprove their narrative since in claiming that this is all Russian aggression, because that's right. Putin was busy distracted with the Olympics, trying to prove what a Western European type of guy he was, how well he got along with the world order, was not plotting to start an aggressive war in Ukraine, was sucking up at the moment. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I have John L. Esposito. He is the co-author of this book with Dalia Mogahed. It's called Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. And it's based on Gallup's World Poll. Welcome back to the show. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good. Very happy to have you back on the show, and I really should interview you once a year or something on this. I don't know of any work that superseded it, certainly. But this is such an important subject, and there is such an unrelenting propaganda campaign from so many different quarters now to keep everyone on such the highest alert that Islam makes people into homicidal maniacs, and you don't need to know anything better about your enemies than what the name of their religion is. And that's about it. That's what we hear all day. Well, I deliberately watch Fox News, so I get it worse than everyone else. But but everyone else too. We just suffer this all day long. Islamic radicalism, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that most Americans just have no, you know, honest picture of what Muslims really think whatsoever. And so what you guys did in this is you didn't just collect some anecdotes. You went and collected anecdotes from Morocco to the Philippines, if I remember it right. I read it back in 08. You went and interviewed as many Muslims and as many different Muslim societies as you could, and you asked them as many questions as you could about what they really think, and you really came up with a lot of surprising conclusions for people, huh?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, regrettably, you know, the extremist events and a lot of reactions overlook what, in fact, the vast majority of that, you know, of the global Muslim community think and believe. And that continues to remain, you know, to remain a significant problem.
All right. And so now tell us a bit about the methodology, because I'm pretty sure I summed it up inaccurately there.
Yeah, well, basically, Gallup developed what they call the World Poll in 2001, and it looked at 130 countries, looking at about 95% of the world's population. Within that, you have polls 2001, 2005, and 2007. Within those polls, they then brought out their focus on some 35 countries in the Muslim world, as you said, that span the Muslim world. And what's important about the polls is this isn't polling by simply, you know, telephone, calling people up briefly, calling people in a certain region. It's polling that takes place where interviewers went out to every strata of society, went from urban areas to towns, to villages, to the most rural areas, and had basically one-on-one interviews done in local languages, et cetera, and cut across from in terms of age, social class, educational background. So at that time, it constituted the most systematic and comprehensive poll of Muslims. And remember, this is you know, occurring in that decade, you know, after 9/11, so a very critical time to take a look and see what do the vast majority out there think, and get beyond what talking heads or academic experts like myself or terrorism experts say, which often can be informed, but did not have that kind of data available to be able to talk with any kind of authority about what a large group of Muslims and diverse group of Muslims across the world really thought and believed on a lot of the issues that I think many Americans were concerned about, and many in the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so now I don't want you to overgeneralize. I wouldn't ask you to overgeneralize. But the way I remember it, there actually were some pretty general truths about how Muslims perceive the United States of America. You know, spanning all that geography and all those different, really different civilizations. If you're talking about, you know, from Morocco to Saudi Arabia to Indonesia, where they believe in Islam, but they're all very different from each other. It seemed like you pretty much could generalize what Muslims really think about the United States, about the American people, and about American foreign policy.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we noticed in the data and subsequent studies, excuse me, by others like Pew, for example, you know, have also corroborated that in fact, Muslims do not view the West monolithically. They distinguish among countries. And certainly back then, they distinguished very clearly between, if you will, the sort of Bush-Blair U.S.-UK on the one hand, and other countries in Europe or Canada on the other. And you could see very, very distinctive differences. That is, very high negative views of the Bush-Blair administrations, particularly its foreign policies in the region, and a much more, you know, as it were, positive assessment. You know, for example, even when you would look at let's say the view of Malaysians looking at the U.S. and Canada. We tend to call Canada the U.S. Without U.S. foreign policy. And just, you know, a shocking, disparity in terms of stats, a very low percentage of negative attitude towards Canada at the time, because, of course, Canada was not involved in invading and occupying Muslim lands. And other things also fed into it, that for example, Muslims admire Americans for the very thing that Americans in general admire about, that is people in the Muslim world, what Americans admire about themselves, our education, our science and technology. But a primary concern is the belief that both Islam and Arabs and Muslims are denigrated, that if you will, Arab and Muslim life is cheap. And I think some of those conclusions get drawn off taking a look at the kinds of battle statistics that have taken place, in the past decade.
Well,
the casualties.
If I remember right, they even like our freedom too, right? Like the Bill of Rights, as in theory, they're afraid of our Guantanamo justice, our practice, but the theory of the American style fair trial, adversarial trial, and you get to face your accusers and all these things, they're all very much in favor of that too, right?
Well, what you have is majorities of Muslims across the world. Now, clearly there are minorities that would disagree, but majorities, significant majorities of Muslims across the world admire the U.S. and want for themselves, which is no brainer. That you wouldn't even need to admire, as it were, the U.S. for wanting to have good governance, rule of law, freedoms, all of those things they see and they admire, the work ethic of Americans. But what they don't admire is their belief and perception and belief that America has a double standard, for example, when it promotes democracy. So they're all for self-determination and democracy, that is, many in the Muslim world. But when they look at American foreign policy and European foreign policy, and of course, this has been corroborated with the extent to which both the U.S. and the EU did not really robustly condemn the coup in Egypt. In fact, the U.S. refused to call it a coup, and the continued support for that. That just reinforces the sense that there's a double standard when it comes to the promotion of democracy in the Muslim world, and instead a support for authoritarian regimes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I know it's very hard to say in very scientific terms in the context of a radio interview like this, but can you tell us, can you discuss the most important causations and correlations between religious extremism and terrorism and what you think it's important for people to understand about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually it's pretty kind of easy. I don't even have to say the normal patter I would. All you have to do is take a look at very recent reports coming out of France and in terms of what happened in Paris with the attacks, but also now, rather late, the French government recognizing that, in fact, a good deal of the problem that they have with extremists are people who are born in regions or if you will, areas outside of Paris, who are born there, have very poor educational systems. Often the educational systems receive almost half of what's poured into educational systems in mainstream Paris, are handicapped, therefore, in terms of employment, in terms of jobs. Therefore, you wind up with areas that become high crime. And you see both there, as well as when they look at the recent assassins in Copenhagen, they're basically described as people that have had problems, with law enforcement, are thugs, and then become vulnerable, often very, very recently, to these, radical jihadist sort of preachers. Many of them, for example, are really not very familiar with the religion of Islam itself. Many of them have never even practiced the religion.
All right. I'm sorry that we have to stop there. We're all out of time, but I hope we can talk again. I really appreciate your work on this, John.
You take care.
All right, y'all. That's John L. Esposito. Get this book. Read it. It's so good. You got to know what's in here. Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, co-written with Dalia Mogahed. And we'll see y'all tomorrow.